This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. You, too, can get the true crime that's worth your time delivered to your inbox every weekday at bestevidence.fyi. And now, on with our episode.
Pat, I understand we had a police shooting here tonight. Can you tell me what happened?
Officers responded to a call of a suspicious person. Individual raised his gun, putting the officer in fear of his life. The offender raised the gun, putting both officers in fear of their life. In defense of his partner's life and his life, the police had to shoot the offenders.
Has it been a rise in police shootings?
I'm not even going to get into that.
We are on both sides of the thin blue line this week, in a way. First, with a recent Showtime documentary, 16 Shots, that tries to keep the death of Laquan McDonald from blending into all the other police-involved deaths of people of color. And later, with the legendary Errol Morris documentary, The Thin Blue Line, whose account of prosecutorial misconduct and death row injustice in Dallas County seems all too fresh in its familiarity. It's all about the relative value of testimony in The Blotter Presents, episode 102. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that considers the idea that while crime is bad, the stories about crime can sometimes be pretty good. I hope we picked a couple good ones for my returning guest, Kevin Smokler. Hello again, Kevin.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, anytime. Let us get right into it with our most wanted selection this week. The documentary film 16 Shots, which aired on Showtime not this past Friday, but the Friday before, I believe. Here is the case file from Showtime's press materials. 16 Shots examines the 2014 shooting of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald by Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke, and the cover-up that ensued. After the police initially declared the shooting was justified, journalists and activists fought for footage of the event to be released, sending the Chicago Police Department and local Chicago government officials into upheaval as the community demanded justice. Director Richard Rowley's film dissects the cover-up through firsthand witness accounts, which led to the unprecedented conviction that fractured the political landscape of Chicago. Little bit of a spoiler there, but we'll just breeze right past that.
It is part of the public record now. It's not,
yes,
we're not telling,
yes,
you something that the world doesn't know.
That's true. But I must say that, and this is something that the film does try to sort of address and bring forward, and it's something that you wanted to discuss, the extremely depressing fact that this case may, for some of us, have just become part of a line of similar cases. Which one was this? Like, was this the Chicago one versus the Ferguson one, the Baltimore one, the Minneapolis one?
Yeah, I remember, I remember when you told me about this documentary and having a moment of recognition where I was like, oh yes, Laquan McDonald killed in a police shooting in the fall of 2014, remembering that and being interested in seeing how the continuation of that story, which I confess I was only slightly familiar with what happened in that case after the incident itself. So I was interested in that. But I also remember feeling a no small degree of shame that the reason I remembered who Laquan McDonald was the song 16 Shots by the hip-hop artist Vic Mensa from Chicago, who I am a big fan of, who created an absolutely chilling musical pastiche. And I say it that way because it was a song followed by sort of an absolutely riveting, haunting instrumental track, which uses the Laquan McDonald 911 dispatch recording as an instrumental, as a piece of the instrumentation. I confess that is the reason I remembered what were the circumstances around Laquan McDonald's death versus Michael Brown and Eric Gardner's that had happened in the summer of 2014, and then Tamir Rice's death that had happened in the late fall, early winter of 2014 after Laquan McDonald. And I hadn't remembered the fact that Philando Castile had been killed almost 2 years later, but Freddie Gray is in there somewhere. And the fact that all of these cases happened states apart and are Americans, you know, of varying economic levels, of different ages, and certainly under different circumstances, what they all have in common is that they were all black citizens, and that they were all killed under suspicious circumstances by the police department in where they lived. Now, we can argue about what things get media coverage and at what pace, and how media coverage is often like a snowball gathering more of itself as it goes downhill. Mm. But I guess just speaking personally, I will say I was horrified down to my toes that it was only because someone had gone so far as to capture the last night of Laquan McDonald's life in a song that I was very fond of that I, in my mind, could distinguish his killing from the half dozen other names that I knew that had happened close to it, even though what they had in common was only an interaction with the police department gone terribly wrong.
Mm. And that these citizens were, I think it's understood, the tip of a terrible iceberg that although these are the ones from sort of a clustered like timeline, mm-hmm. that this has, you know, obviously been going on since time immemorial and has continued to go on. And as a New Yorker, we have our own litany of NYPD shame in this regard, going back, like, even if we only go back as far as I've been living here, Amadou Diallo, through Eric Garner and, you know, everyone in between who did not have the ambiguous benefit of, you know, internet, like of living in an age of social media, of, the, you know, occurring at this time where a brighter light would be shown upon it. So I felt the same way that you did about my own response to it, which was, you know, oh, this is the Chicago one. Like, not to sound like I was being sort of cynical and who cares about it, but just the sheer volume of it is a lot. And that's mostly tied to, it's not a not caring issue. It's a volume issue that I think you also see with mass shootings, unfortunately. And
quite so.
The film addresses this fairly quickly. Here's clip two.
I think it's a level of people being desensitized from the violence. That's what we've been seeing for so many years. Like, why protest? Nothing's gonna change. Why go after this? Nothing's gonna change. On and after, from my understanding, it was just a black man that lodged at the Chicago police and was shot and killed. I didn't even know his name was Laquan.
And, you know, this is an activist, so it's it's not just us and, you know, possibly other listeners who sort of struggle to keep the sheer volume of these murders or attacks of brutality straight in our heads, because it seems like it's, you know, it marches on.
Yeah, I almost feel for our purposes here, and it didn't come up in that fantastic book you recommended I read, the Popular Crime by Bill James, which is sort of the history of true crime in the media in this country. It didn't come up in that book, but I almost felt like it was implied that for our purposes here, part of the interest in true crime and true crime stories, perhaps there needs to be a sort of rather fat index in the back indicating that part of that is the story of police scandal and police misconduct, law enforcement response to crime. Lest we get a picture that true crime is entirely evil people being apprehended by noble police departments and detectives. The history of popular culture, the history of popular culture in this country alone surrounding police and law enforcement scandal is big enough for its own film festival and its own podcast. And rather ignominiously, we have one for every large and small municipality in this nation. I think anybody who knows anything about the history of where they live can probably cite sometime in history an awful police scandal that ruined lives in that place. Mm. And I don't think we can really talk about this thing called true crime in any sort of complete or large way without including that.
I agree. I will say that, first of all, my hometown did have a police scandal. I'm not sure that lives were ruined, but there was a raid on the local high school's guidance counselor files, I believe in an attempt to root out users of the marijuana.
Oh, wow.
And this caused a major uproar, rightly, because that's fucked up. Settle down, Summit PD. And I will also add that I think it's in Popular Crime that Bill James, who talks about our second topic today for a few pages, but also talks about in the context of a case in not Mary Rogers necessarily, but some similar case in like the middle of the 19th century in New York City, and talking about how many police officers and detectives were like quote former ne'er-do-wells.
Mm.
The idea being that, first of all, policing is tough work and you need tough guys to do it. And second of all, who knows better how a crook thinks than another crook? And he was saying, you know, I say this without judgment, but I don't think this was the worst idea they ever had. It wasn't maybe the best, but, you know, either way, this is how it was.
Yeah.
Back then. But your point is absolutely taken. I think that there is a I'm not sure what you would call it, like it, the subgenre of like crime documentaries and crime coverage that would be like, you know, who's on the whole system's on trial, or hashtag who's zooming who. Like I'm not sure how you would call it, but yeah, you're absolutely right. We'll definitely see that in the cold case as well. Overall, 16 Shots is well built, very competent. They get extremely impressive access to both sides of this equation, I thought. We heard from a longtime police, or the whatever benevolent order of police bears spokesperson, up top there. They talk to various like advocates. They talk to Van Dyke's attorney. These are sometimes dog whistly and off-putting interviews, but the fact that I can't imagine that the director and his team go in with the request, and it's like, well, this documentary, and maybe it wasn't called that, but like, oh, this is called 16 Shots. Would you like to talk to us about the role of the police in this case? Like, you know, it's pretty impressive that they got so many people on both sides of the question of whether Jason Van Dyke murdered Laquan McDonald.
Yeah.
To all talk to them. So I was impressed by that, and I was also impressed in the sense that it left an impression. by how the this disputed footage, which was sort of at the center of everything that the city did not want to release, that was eventually released of, this was a dash cam, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't a body cam.
No.
Of Laquan's death. That I just found, I mean, I teared up. It was just heartbreaking. And then they show it again, slowed down, so that you really get the point. And I remember thinking, you know what? I felt a little bit angry that this was done, and then I just felt sad all over again. What did you think of that choice?
I have never seen a sort of law enforcement manual, you know, of tactical command and procedure or anything like that. So this is me guessing, but me simply speak,
you know, the fuck do we know?
Like, yeah, exactly.
We're not walking beats. We don't. We just know what we see in these documentaries. So grain of salt.
But my educated, in quotes, guess on what an officer does once a suspect is down and that suspect is outnumbered, you know, 9 to 1 or something, is once that suspect is down, you swarm them and you move in, swarm them, and get them away from their weapon and immobilize them. I don't know why the footage, and maybe because it was footage in an obvious case of police misconduct, it reminds me a little of the Rodney King beating, which was then placed into context for me when many years later I read a book about the history of the LAPD. And in assessing the Rodney King beating, one of the author of the book dug up a manual, this manual that you and I haven't seen, a manual of police procedure. And it turned out that in that case, Stacy Coon, who was the senior officer on the scene, called in before they stopped Rodney King and his two friends and said, "I am the senior officer here. I am assuming tactical command of this situation." In which case, everybody else who you see standing around in that video should have said, "Copy that," and gone home. And gone back to the station. In fact, we see 20 officers standing around in that case because they're bored. And I think what they don't realize is that 20 officers on the scene of a routine traffic stop is going to escalate rather than de-escalate the situation. Now, we could argue that Laquan McDonald walking down the center of a busy freeway holding a knife is perhaps a more obvious case of lawbreaking than speeding, the way Rodney King and his friends were, and perhaps a potentially more dangerous situation. You know, Rodney King's car was pulled over in the early morning hours. I believe a Sunday. There probably wasn't anybody on the road. But still, I feel like procedurally speaking, Laquan McDonald, as soon as he hit the ground, the firing should have stopped, and police should have swarmed the now down suspect in an attempt to get the knife away from him. The idea,
particularly given that it was a knife,
yeah,
and that if you had immobilized him, it's if he can still reach the knife, like he's down.
Yeah, the idea that nine armed officers are in danger by one suspect holding a knife who is now lying prone on the pavement is just horseshit. Is just rationalization for them acting foolishly and then attempting to dismiss or justify it by saying they were in danger.
If you are given live ammunition, for this purpose, you need to be able to hit the man's kneecap from 20 feet away, or you shouldn't be firing. Like, I'm sorry, there needs to be a marksmanship standard that prioritizes merely wounding a suspect, quote unquote. I think they were not allowed to call him a victim in court.
Yeah.
He was the offender.
Which seems very wrong.
And, you know, there's also like, there, this was sort of not settled to my satisfaction in the film. Maybe you had a different take on it, but there were like mentions of the possibility that he had PCP in his system, which I don't really feel like that was, there was a conclusion reached one way or the other.
No.
And I understand that PCP can make its participants rather more difficult to subdue or communicate with. But again, A, they had no way to know that. B, that's your fucking job too goddamn bad. And C, you just shot the guy. He's subdued. You can stop shooting. Move on to the next step.
It would seem to me that accurately judging how dangerous a suspect is like requirement number one of wearing a badge, having a gun, and patrolling the street.
Well,
and if you can't do it, then what are you doing?
This guy was, what, in his mid-30s at the time that he shot Laquan?
Yeah.
Van Dyke was in his mid to late 30s. Like, if you don't have a better idea of who poses a legitimate threat to you... well, whatever. We'll get to that clip later. But
yeah, with a decade on the force, at least.
I
do wonder if I wonder if not only in that determination, like do we have a cop? Like who has a fair amount of experience, like not making use of it, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But we also have I think the PCP claim to me is a Rodney King / similar kind of stops dog whistle, because
in my
limited experience with this, white people are never accused of having PCP in their system and therefore being difficult to subdue in an arrest situation. Meth as a substance makes you twice as crazy as PCP does, but meth is a white person's drug. And the same was said about Rodney King. The same was said about Rodney King, that Rodney King was some sort of crazed lunatic because he was sitting in the passenger seat of a car and had done a little PCP earlier that night. It strikes me as it's not much different than saying this guy wasn't a model citizen, and therefore, like, how did you expect us as law enforcement officers to act towards him?
Well, right. I absolutely agree. I think it's one step up from the there was the obvious smell of marijuana in the vehicle excuse for searching it because they're African American.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
or Latinx, or whatever your actual reason was. The sort of dog cop, like the blue dog whistle for that is, you know, I smelled marijuana in the car and asked everybody to step out, and that's where it often goes.
I believe that was what was said, you know, in the mere seconds before Philando Castile was killed. I believe it.
Yes, I believe you're correct. Moving on for a moment from the shooting, which is bad enough, to the like near instantaneous efforts of other parts of the police department to change or normalize or bring into line witness testimony, recollections of the event, to sort of impugn Laquan McDonald as a person, as though he was walking down the street with a sandwich board of his past youthful misdeeds, which still would not have been an excuse. Our next clip is several witnesses saying that the police were quite determined to get a certain version of these statements and would not let up.
I talked to several detectives, not one, and they kept asking me the same questions over and over again. What did you see? How many gunshots did you hear? The more I kept telling them of what I saw, they were trying to make me... They would tell me stuff like, well, we're watching the video and your story does not match. And I said, well, if it doesn't match, then, and you have a video, what am I doing here? And they said, well, you know, it's not good to lie. They really wanted me to change the story about how many shots I had heard. If I didn't tell them what they wanted to hear, I definitely thought I was going to go to jail.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
Basically, like this immediate swinging into place of the sort of the rest of the fraternal order, sort of this closing of ranks of the blue wall. That was like a million different figures of speech that I all mixed them all together. Why not? It just is. I mean. And it's so predictable too. Like, I think that at this point in my crime property reviewing career, that I have seen enough documentaries like this and seen enough accounts of false confessions and of witnesses agreeing to change their statements based on, you know, like a motivation provided by the police. It's like, well, perhaps we could round file those like petty larceny charges or drop this desk ticket or like whatever the reasons are. I just feel like you see this in so many cases. We just saw it in When They See Us to an extent that it's just like, well, of course this happened. And I feel like I may be becoming desensitized to, well, that's not the right way to put it, because I was going to say maybe I'm getting desensitized to police misconduct, but what I think is actually happening is that nobody has to make documentaries about police who are ethical and don't do this shit. So I think I might be becoming like a like really anti-cop after watching all of this stuff, because it just keeps coming up over and over again.
Yeah, the part, there's two things here. One, I do understand in the abstract when police officers say, how can you trust the guy you're on patrol with in a life-threatening situation if when the chips are down, he is going to squeal on you to Eternal sure. Affairs or to the media or to your superior or something like that. And sure. So that is the justification for closing ranks when something like this goes horribly wrong. Accepting that I am not a police officer, I would reply with, do you want a guy who has no self-control and doesn't know how to handle himself in a difficult situation? Do you want him making mistakes like that with, you know, while he is patrolling?
And obliging you to cover for him or her.
Yes. Do you want someone who is going to ask you to who is going to ask you or expect you to participate in rotten, corrupt, amoral police work? And how do you expect the citizenry to believe that you are the good guys if that is an expectation of the job?
Yeah.
The second part of that that really gets to me is, I accept with my whole heart that law enforcement is an incredibly difficult job. I do accept that it is also a public servant's job. And it is a job that needs to be done with the highest degree of professionalism, because the consequences of it are that dire, and that's what makes it an important job. Yeah. What I'm afraid the police departments of this country, if I can be really grand and soapboxy about it for a second, need to let go of is that police work is some sort of, you know, inherited, you know, some sort of inheritance passed on from father to son or from uncle to nephew, and that everybody who can't and that the police department should be a place for your, you know, your third cousin who can't find a job in the family business because he's stealing from the till. Like, police work is an elite job. It can't be a difficult job that, by the way, anybody can do.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there's also, you know, first of all, going back to this sort of history, at least of NYPD, and I'm sure it's not unique to NYPD, of having like headbusters do the job, possibly recruiting in the city prison for tough guys, that there, you go back to that and you look at that history, and then you look at the very mafia-esque like code of silence. Not that they're gangsters, but that the institution can seem like this mobbed up union in terms of how difficult it is to get into, how fiercely loyal it is to itself, the lengths it will go to perpetuate itself and its versions of stories. I mean, I have to think that there's a better way to approach, for the institution to approach its relationship with itself, if that makes any sense.
It does. It does. Like, if we are to submit that the Chicago PD in this case, or any police department of any size in this country, that the institution working is somehow based on the public trust, that is irreconcilable in an oil and water kind of way with secrecy, with circling the wagons, with, you know, Blue Lives Matter being code for a cop is never wrong.
Yeah.
And the truth is, like, I would love to sit down with a higher up in my local police department and say, what would really be the consequences if, when the next Laquan McDonald incident comes along, you just say, you know what, we have thoroughly investigated this matter and it was our mistake. It was our mistake. The officer in charge has been duly punished. The police department sincerely regrets this mistake. Sometimes these things happen. It is not a perfect job. And we have taken due action with the officers involved, and we have modified police training so we will teach the next generation of officers what to do better in this situation. I would hear that, and I would say the police department has my back as a citizen. I see them circling the wagons, and I see them circling the wagons and putting up a blue wall, and I say the police department thinks that the very laws they enforce do not apply to them.
Yeah. And that we're stupid.
Yeah. And that the public is somehow a herd of cattle to be prodded into their definition of a law abiding pen.
Yeah. And it just, I mean, and we're a couple of white people, so this can be theoretical to us. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In a way that for citizens of color, it is really not optional. Like, you're not sort of sitting around wool gathering on prospective improvements. You're just out
so
there
true.
Trying not to get killed. And there was a, I believe she's the current state's attorney in Chicago, and she ran against the incumbent who got raked over the coals for this, and who is also interviewed in this documentary. Anita Alvarez, I believe, is her name. Kim Fox ran basically on a Anita Alvarez platform. Obviously she had experience and some more ideas besides that, but this next clip is her talking about how this was sort of like the first like public digesting of a case like this for Chicago, but only in the sense that it was the first public accounting for it. Anyway, here's clip four.
Yeah, yeah. Chicago has not had to reckon with what happens when you don't hold folks in law enforcement accountable for their misdeeds. Parts of the force have acted in a way where they're immune from any accountability for what's happened. My mother, when I had my children, I have two daughters, was so grateful that I didn't have sons. And I thought, oh, you're grateful because you get more children that look like me. And you get to relive having a daughter. And she said, no, because I don't want you to feel what it feels like to worry about your son in this city.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
That's a riff on, you know, when former President Obama said that, you know, if I had sons instead of daughters, they would look like Trayvon Martin.
Yeah. There's also sort of an undercurrent through all of this, but not necessarily addressed per se, is the idea that Chicago is still a fairly segregated city geographically, which I thought it was interesting that that didn't necessarily come up except kind of in passing or as a cumulative sense from various interviews and from the experience of the documentary. So
yeah, it's only hinted at very briefly. There's a comment at the beginning that I think it's one of the FOP guys makes about crossing Pulaski Highway and being in another world. And he says it about Jason Van Dyke. It's actually later in the documentary at the beginning of the trial. He said Jason Van Dyke came from a suburban environment and, you know, hadn't really been exposed to any of these kind of things. And I'm thinking
I pulled that clip.
Oh,
so
okay.
Let's have a listen and then yeah. I'm going to do some yelling about that bullshit.
Okay. I took a couple steps towards him. Yeah.
Well, you took more than a couple of steps because you go all the way out past your squad car, correct? The end of your squad car?
I'm not sure.
I just killed somebody. I'm from a suburb outside Chicago in a very non-diverse environment I grew up in. And I come into the middle of the most violent city in one of the most violent neighborhoods, and you're telling me I should have realized I stepped forward or backward?
All right, I think we disagree on what Jason Van Dyke is experiencing when he's on the stand. That interview in the middle is mm-hmm. the most infuriating fucking horseshit that I've heard in a while, and I watch a lot of true crime documentaries, so I hear fucking infuriating horseshit all the time. Like, are you actually acting like we are supposed to feel pity for a veteran officer with, P.S., multiple excessive force notes in his file? Because he came from a white suburb and he isn't used to black people. So not only was he in shock from murdering one of them in a complete overkill fashion, but we're also supposed to feel sorry for him because he's not used to black people? Are you fucking kidding? I was so mad writing my notes about that quote that my pen went through the paper. I really think that we're supposed to feel sorry for Jason Van Dyke, and I don't think he's glad he killed Laquan McDonald, but he killed him. He overkilled him. This was coming. His COs should have seen this coming. And now that the chickens have come home to roost, he's going to have to fucking live with it like a grown-up, which he is. He was not a 21-year-old right out of the police academy.
No, I'm. It's it's a, I agree with everything you're saying, even though like what I put on our pre-show notes may not make it seem as such. First of all, when the former FOP said that thing about like the neighborhood that Jason Vand, I was ready to like drag him behind his like shit ass suburban shit box and like drown him in his above ground pool. Like, excuse me. Yes, Jason McDonald is not 21. He's not right out of the academy. He was 40 years old when that trial happened. He'd been on the force a dozen years. And unless he had arrived at, you know, CPD headquarters yesterday and had been policing in John Hughes's neighborhood before that, this guy has seen it all, has been exposed to every facet of Chicago citizenry in 12 years of patrolling the streets of that city. Don't try and sell me some steaming pile that he felt uncomfortable in a situation stopping someone on the middle of the street. It's called policing, sir. That's what you do. Like, to me, that's like an air traffic controller saying, oh my God, I couldn't deal with all the planes landing and it was raining. You know? Yeah. That's the job.
Yeah. So, and also, you called the plane an N-word.
Yeah, exactly. Like, exactly. The part
maybe
that
this isn't the job for you, yeah, sir.
The part that the part where I had a glimmer of sympathy for Jason Van Dyke, is that Jason Van Dyke sits down on the stand and says, "I'm 40 years old." The attorney says, "What's your name?" He gives his name. Who employs you? Chicago Police Department. How old are you? 40 years old. I said to myself, "No, he's not. That guy looks like he's 22." I'm like, God, this guy looks like a kid. And then for some reason, I immediately flashed in my mind to this photo in the New York Times that was taken of Justin Volpe. Justin Volpe was the NYPD officer who received the largest sentence in the Abner Louima police beating.
Because he looked like a fucking gangster.
Yeah. Justin Volpe was a big, beefy guy with a severe side part. And
no
it was
neck.
A photo. Yeah, no neck. And it was a photo of him walking in the courtroom. And the entire photo said, yeah, I did it and I'll do it again. It was the picture of a remorseless guy who thought like a nightstick gave him a license to kill. And that wasn't Jason Van Dyke, and I don't even know if that's an important distinction to make.
And I don't think that necessarily was Justin Volpe either. Like, I think he did what he was accused of for sure, but I think he also looked the part.
Yeah, the moment I had the feeling I had, and I'm not gonna carve this in marble or something, but the feeling I had when I saw him break down on the stand was not, please give me sympathy because I'm crying at this horrible thing I did. The feeling I had for him in a brief moment, and I don't think this assuages his guilt one bit, is that I am being forced by my profession and the people who said they were going to have my back to lie. To me, the tears on Jason Van Dyke's face was the shredding of the thin blue line, like before his very eyes. Like,
well, and I think that he was, I think the breakdown was sincere. Like, there's a quote right after this where, one of his attorneys, I believe, is like, you know, the jury believed that he feared for his life, and it's like, look, I also believe that he feared for his life. That's the fucking problem, though. Right?
Yeah.
That he sees an African American with a knife and is like, woe is me, police officer with a gun, years of experience and official training.
And eight other officers like me backing me up.
Yeah. Like, like, how am I supposed to hear that when a veteran of the police department is, like, in fear for his life because someone is walking while black?
Mm-hmm.
It's an extremely dangerous, difficult job. I'm sure it's very, like, wearing emotionally as well as physically. But, like, then be in the property room. If it's that hard and you want that pension, be an evidence tech. There's things you could do.
Yeah.
In our final clip, we have another activist saying that it wasn't actually, like, the public response was not about the 16 shots. It was about CPD gaslighting us about whether it even happened. So here's our last clip.
This didn't happen because Laquan McDonald was shot 16 times, right? This only happened after a year of a cover-up.
This task force
is an attempt by Rahm Emanuel,
to salvage his reputation after his criminal mishandling
of the Laquan McDonald tape.
And I respect and appreciate this time. Try not to.
Bullshit!
Yeah, this is not even getting into the careers left in shambles by, like, refusing to engage productively with people's legitimate outrage at this murder. So,
yeah. I sometimes wonder if I understand that the culture of sort of civic and local government machinery runs very deep in Chicago. I mean, at the very least, you know, back to Prohibition. But I also understand that, like, has nobody read, you know, the basic history book that they supposedly hand you? When, I mean, I don't know if they hand it to you, but does nobody know how these things turn out? Like, yes.
Yeah.
Of course there are cases we don't know about of the Chicago machine humming along just fine and everybody, you know, keeping their jobs and eating and feasting happily off, you know, a low level hum of corruption and favoritism. But when stuff bubbles to the surface, it almost always ends badly for people in government. And so I think, you know, Rahm Emanuel, for example, who was not considered a particularly trustworthy person at this point in his administration, would have done a whole lot better to just say, well, we are going to investigate this fully, and done so. And he was like, well, if you don't have you may not have the support of the police department then. He's like, well, fine, you know what? There's a lot of voters in this town. Like, I'll go scratch up my 51% majority somewhere else. And if I'm mayor for another 4 years, the police department's going to have to work with me anyway. Like, I don't understand why people so fear holding on to their jobs that they're willing to do something that if it ever reached the light of day would be the end of their jobs anyway.
Yeah, well, and especially in Chicago, where it's like, I think that people have gotten used to, and, you know, I'm projecting my experience growing up in New Jersey, but I think sometimes when you're in an environment where a certain level of corruption is considered not only normal, but salutary to the functioning of systems, that you just get used to people being kind of grubbly, incompetent, and self-serving, and you don't, it's like, well, this isn't that much worse than usual, so why insist on an accounting that is probably never coming? It's like that guy said at the beginning, that in that early clip, that he's like, you know, you just get used to nothing ever changing. And it's like, well, and you can't really put that on the citizenry, honestly.
No, the system has its own, you know, gravitational pull at some point.
Yeah, it definitely does. Well, overall, I would say this is worth hunting down. Certainly if you have Showtime or you want, I think maybe you can rent this as part of like a plus package on Hulu. But if you're doing the, like, I'm going to upgrade and do a 7-day free trial for like 4th of July weekend, next week, then definitely check this out. Showtime actually has a lot of great documentaries about all sorts of topics, and this one is worth checking out. It's not like groundbreaking, but it's very good. It's very well made. All right, moving on to our cold case, which for want of a dash cam video might not have dragged on for so long and with such adverse consequences for some of its central figures. We are speaking, of course, of one of the seminal properties in the true crime genre, Errol Morris's film The Thin Blue Line, which I believe came out in 1988.
Yes.
Here is the case file adapted somewhat from Wikipedia. This is sort of like one of those sprawling tales with many reversals, so I tried to chop it down and be reasonable, but it does occur to me that while I think many people know that this is a, you know, on the true crime documentary Mount Rushmore and have a sort of vague sense of where it was and what happened, you may not know the details. I will try to keep this brief. Randall Adams always maintained that he was wrongfully convicted of the November 28, 1976 murder of Dallas police officer Robert Wood, a crime for which Adams was convicted and sentenced to death. Adams insisted that the man he believed to be Wood's killer, David Ray Harris, had offered him a ride on the day of the shooting after his own car had run out of gasoline. Adams and Harris had spent several hours together but had parted ways prior to the shooting. Under an immunity agreement, Harris testified for the prosecution that Adams was the shooter of Officer Wood while he was the passenger in the car. Based on the testimony of Harris and other alleged eyewitnesses, Adams was found guilty. While incarcerated, Adams was the subject of the 1988 documentary film Thin Blue Line, which was cited as being instrumental in his exoneration the following year. Writer-director Errol Morris knew that Harris had, on multiple occasions, bragged about shooting a police officer. He later uncovered evidence of prosecutorial misconduct and eyewitness misidentification. Morris did, not Harris. During an interview with Harris, Morris was able to record audio of him giving a pseudo-confession to the murder. In 2004, Harris was executed by lethal injection for an unrelated 1985 murder. He was never charged with Wood's murder. 6 months after the film's release, Adams' conviction was overturned by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and prosecutors declined to retry him. Adams was released and lived in anonymity until his death in 2010. The Thin Blue Line pioneered a number of documentary techniques, the straight-on talking head interview, scene reenactments, as well as the idea of prestige true crime. Less beneficially, the film, the post-release outcome for Adams, and the elevating of Morris to crime doc Mount Rushmore may have convinced the filmmaker that his taking up of Jeffrey McDonald's allegedly unfair trial was anything but an edgelord misstep. But we're here to discuss the idiots who fall for McDonald's horseshit. Janet Malcolm, just kidding, we're not here to do that. Had you seen this before? I had watched Thin Blue Line before, but it had been decades, probably.
I had, yes. The Thin Blue Line was... I was 16 when The Thin Blue Line came out, and I was enthralled at the time with the series Unsolved Mysteries, as we've talked about on this program before. When I read about... I think I heard about it on Siskel and Ebert, their old television show, and I thought, this is just my kind of movie. I didn't really know what documentaries were. I didn't have an opinion one way or another. I was mostly living in ignorance. But I remembered seeing it, and it was the movie that got me interested in the documentary film form at all. So I feel very warmly towards this movie, and I hope that doesn't keep me from, you know, viewing it maturely. But I've probably seen it 8 to 10 times since then, including most recently this morning. And I still, to say something that's like sort of so obvious a compliment, it's just part of the paint on the walls. It's a movie that I remember something differently about every time I see it. I think there's that much richness in the material.
I think I didn't see it until, I think there was some delay involving its release on home video for rental.
Oh, I can imagine that, yeah.
Because I believe the release that Adams had signed involving the rights to his life story was like, he felt that once he had been released from prison, that it, you know, he was entitled to more than he had gotten. And I think he sued the distributor, or I don't know what happened. He, like, his comments on it sort of seem like, look, you know, nothing against Errol Morris, but when I thought I was going to be executed, things looked a little different in terms of the rights to my life story, which, fair enough. Mm-hmm. And so I think they had to settle all of that before they could release it on video. So I didn't see it until I think the mid 90s. And it seemed sort of like new, like contemporary. And when you watch it, like, the film stock is obviously of a certain age, but this is so, like, the outlines of the construction of the film are so familiar. Like, there's a couple of places where you're like, this reenactment is, like, really a little melodramatic, but then you remember that nobody really did this before. So when a milkshake is, like, whatever, dramatically hitting the ground and then leaking into the, you know, sandy soil on the shoulder, you're like, all right, settle down. And then you're like, oh yeah, he was the first person to be like, look at the contrast, the innocence of a malted, the murder of a police officer. And you're like, okay, oh my God, like, chill out. But he was the first to do that. So, yeah. I mean, it still feels very, there's not a lot in it that you look at it and you're like, oh, I wouldn't do that. Or, like, I would tune that out. Like, there are some scenes where it's maybe a little much, but it still holds up really well because he has such a sort of good internal ear for how to serve this story, including the fact that this wasn't the story he even set out to tell. And he quickly realized midstream that there was a much more interesting narrative available.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure Errol Morris, in fact, I'm positive Errol Morris could not have predicted this, but in a movie that it is really about different ideas of truth and narrative, it is one of the few documentaries where history is actually on your side, because if you remember it differently each time you saw it, you are actually living in the theme of the movie. You are actually participating in what the movie wants you to take from it. And I, yes, those individual gestures can seem a little like 10th grade theater production-y.
Because 10th grade theater productions are copying him.
Right. I mean, there's one that may not be a grievous error, but it sort of stuck in my mind this time as one, where in the initial telling of the killing of police officer Wood, he falls to the ground and his flashlight is intact. And then in one of the reenactments, the flashlight hurtles through the air and the lens is shattered as it hits the pavement.
Yeah,
I know this was before the era of mag lights and shatterproof flashlights, but it's weird. Like, yeah, some of those gestures can seem kind of patently silly, and then, or at least like less slick than we imagine them being now. But you're right. If you think of this in the aggregate, like, for a movie that is about different ideas of truth, and for a movie that was made 30 years ago, before we started safely assuming that documentaries were part of cinematic pop culture, I think it's quite remarkable and holds up as still remarkable.
Yeah, I agree. It's about an hour and 40. It's not, you know, too short. It's not too long. It has that bang up ending, of course. We'll get to that. But I think that it's very well laid out. The sort of outlines of, you know, the outlines of the story here are that a police officer was shot, and the rest of the Dallas police force and the prosecutor and the judge and the world wanted someone to burn for it. So they basically chose to take the word of a law-abiding 28-year-old who they could send to death row over a little 16-year-old scuzzbag who had a long record already, because he was a nice, polite scuzzbag who was 16 and couldn't be sent to the chair. So that's basically all there is to it. Like, they knew what they wanted to happen, and they made it happen, and facts were not invited to the party. And so let's hear Randall Adams' account of the cops being like, oh, no, we wrote your confession and you're going to sign it. Here's clip 7.
He said that I would sign it. He didn't give a damn what I said. I would sign this piece of paper he's got. I told him I couldn't. You know, I don't know what the hell you people expect of me, but there's no way I could sign that. He left. He came back in 10 minutes and threw a pistol on the table. Asked me to look at it, which I did. I looked. He asked me to pick it up. I told him no, I wouldn't do that. He threatened me. Again, I told him no. He pulled his service revolver on me.
They just yeah. had an idea, and they were going to make the story fit their idea, and that was pretty much that, including a whole string of witnesses that came up sort of at the last minute, and as it turns out, you know, there's like a married couple that they don't even believe each other, and the husband is calling the wife a serial snitch, and then they're like getting out of petty theft charges in exchange for this testimony that is like, you know, no relationship to fact. It's right. really, I think what makes it seem so contemporary, sadly, is again that we've heard a version of this story many times. When They See Us, Paradise Lost, any of the cases in the confession tapes, either season, the list of times when this doesn't happen is probably shorter, that the cops are like, you know, we're closing this shit, get with the program, guy with an 82 IQ. And the next thing you know, so...
And I don't understand what goes through the minds of not only cops, but district attorneys and prosecutors, when they're thinking like, okay, we've got a shaky case, but it's better than no case. I don't understand. Like, yes, if you're the West Memphis, Arkansas Police Department and you're under-resourced and you need to solve a triple murder, I maybe can understand that, as vile and morally repugnant as it is. If you are the well-funded Dallas Police Department and you're talking about the killing of a police officer on the job, this is a priority one investigation.
Yeah, don't you throw want the every guy resource who actually did it?
Yes, you
who
throw every resource.
Said he did it?
You throw every resource you can, and if someone turns up, it doesn't matter who it is. It doesn't matter if you get to put him in the chair or not. Robert Wood's widow doesn't care. Robert Wood's widow cares that you caught the person who murdered her husband. And if it's a 16-year-old punk who was going to be on a collision course with a violent crime anyway, which turns out he was, unrelated to this case, I don't understand why catching someone who you can't send to the chair seems like you know, getting a bronze, it seems like coming in second place. I don't understand that at all.
Maybe that's a Texas thing. I don't know.
Yeah, it is not going to catch up with you in the end. As if there aren't enough of these cases where a flimsy rickety prosecution has collapsed to the ground in splinters. you just reeled three of them off with probably, you know, standing on one foot. So,
I don't understand why
they never think that someone's going to catch on, and that engaging in this perjury and lying is somehow better than actually putting in the time and effort to catch the real killer, even if the prosecution is not ideal.
Yeah, I just don't like these things can take a while. Mm-hmm. That's okay.
Yeah.
Especially since, like, actually the guy that really did it was out there continuing to terrorize his community. A fact that everyone in said community was pretty well acquainted with. Like,
yeah.
I just sort of think about, like, if, God forbid, my actual brother, not just sort of my, like, you know, policeman brother, metaphorically speaking, were murdered, am I going to be like, okay, well, you know, you live down the street from him and you don't actually remember where you were that night. I guess it was you. Let's lock you up. Yeah. What? Who thinks like that?
Yeah, I understand that we are talking about, I'm sure we're talking about a very specific moment in the history of the Dallas Police Department. It took decades for the Dallas Police Department to wash off the stain of the Kennedy assassination, that they had somehow ineptly handled that crime and allowed Jack Ruby to waltz into the basement of the Dallas Police Department and assassinate the person charged with the murder of the president. And there had, in 1971, there had been a terrible case of two petty thieves kidnapping and later murdering three Dallas police officers, known as the Trinity River Massacre, which was probably fresh in the memory of the department still on this, you know, terrible day and over Thanksgiving weekend in 1976. Nonetheless, like, I think if the obvious suspect presents themselves, even if you don't get a big showy conviction out of them, like, why not take it? Why not take it and give, you know, and give Robert Wood's widow and children the closure that they're actually looking for? Well, and the community's looking for,
too. It turns out that in David Harris's hometown of Vidor, Texas, they felt pretty strongly that he shouldn't be Brock Turnered into actually accepting punishment for the crimes that he had committed, despite all his friends being like, yeah, he had no conscience about anything. And actually, the only reason we didn't think he killed the guy is because he was also a compulsive liar, like with friends like these, etc. But here is defense attorney Edith James, who represented Adams and who has this, like, delightful, almost accidental snark to her comments. Here's a clip in which she's like pretending to sort of relay with some bafflement the ideas of law enforcement in Vidor, Texas, but is clearly throwing shade at them. And at the beginning of the clip, it's some of Little David's friends expressing the idea that he's a sociopath.
He didn't have a conscience, you know. You know, if I do something bad, you know, it kind of gets me. I feel, you know, shucks, you know, I shouldn't have done that. I feel bad about it. Didn't bother him. Didn't bother him at all.
We asked the DA in Vidor, Texas, what they were going to do with Little David. And they said, oh, we'll send him to the Texas Youth Council. And we sort of tried to inquire, didn't he think it was a little strange that there was a robbery committed with that same pistol, you know? And here it was, David Harris's pistol, David Harris's automobile that picked up Randall Adams. Didn't he think it was a little odd that all the utensils for committing this so-called murder were furnished by David Harris, who got off scot-free and was being a witness for the prosecution? And all he said was, well, ho-hum, we don't feel that way in Vidor, Texas. Our people just are not that, you know, we're not that keen on ruining a young man's life.
Well, your boy shot a cop so he wouldn't get caught having stolen a car and the gun he used. So I feel like Little David is all set on ruining his own life, and you could just get out of the way and let Dallas County take care of their business.
Yeah, he was, to me, it seemed like David Harris was like a pint-sized Ken McElroy. Like, he's just like someone who sort of terrorized with impunity this local community, and he would have become Ken McElroy, if he had started criminality at age 40 like Ken McElroy did, as opposed to at age 12 like he did, like David Harris had. I think what is implied.
What is the name? What is the name of that book about McElroy?
In Broad Daylight.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, it's a great book. I wonder if in what Edith in the interaction with the Vider DA that Edith James is recounting, what the Vider DA is actually saying is, we don't take too kindly to you big city lawyers coming in here and telling us how to run our district attorney's office.
I think it absolutely was, because there's a whole segment in the film about how Vidor was like a clan mini capital, and that people of color would not stay there after sundown.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't get out of there alive if they didn't leave. So, I think there's definitely some of that. And another attorney, was it Adams's appellate attorney? The one who looks like Sidney Pollack, whose name is Dennis White.
Oh, no, that's Edith James's co-counsel, okay. Dennis White. Yeah.
That he, I'll play a clip from him in a second, but at some point he says that the DA... Doug Mulder, who I think retired with an absolutely perfect record of convictions, which is extremely suspicious to me, and also does not appear in the movie, but Mulder let it be known to the jury that Dennis White was a quote Eastern educated like city attorney, which was definitely dog whistling about like Ivy League elite Jewish
it's anti-Semitic dog whistling, definitely.
Yeah, for sure. Here he is talking about the fact that after an absolutely inadequate and almost laughable, if it weren't so serious, interview with Adams, based on which Dr. Grigson, aka Dr. Death, who is the guy that Errol Morris set out to make the documentary about, because based on his recommendations, this is how judges and juries would sort of decide whether this capital offender was going to reoffend, thereby sending him to death row. He never said they weren't going to. After this horribly inadequate interview, naturally, Adams ends up on death row. Here is Dennis White explaining, and this is like years later, and he still seems completely flummoxed by how fucked up this is in clip 10.
Yeah.
In death penalty cases, we have a question, or we did at the time, of whether or not that person is of a dangerous mentality and might be expected to commit other crimes. To answer that question, the Dallas District Attorney's Office sends psychiatrists into the defendant's cell to discover whether he is without remorse and therefore is a dangerous and psychopathic personality. Well, of course, in the instance of a person who did not commit the crime, naturally, they're not going to show much remorse. There were two psychiatrists that appeared again and again, Holbrook and Grigson, the killer shrinks. There were a certain amount of criticism directed against these two people. Because, in effect, whenever they showed up, the purpose of their visit was to kill the defendant.
He starts out sort of circumspect. He's like, yes, occasionally people were not entirely positive about these two individuals. And then he just goes for it. These two figures and their talking head interviews are... perfect in the context of I think they, in many ways, stand in for the viewer in their, like, sincere and lasting confusion as to how this entire case got fucked into a cocked hat, like, immediately, and then stayed there for a dozen years until Errol Morris was like, hey, this is weird. So they also provide sort of a terrain, like, within the movie that gives you a little bit of a break from feeling, even though these events occurred 3 decades ago, it, like, impotently enraged by the injustice. So that's one of the things that I think is very well done in The Thin Blue Line in terms of the build of it, that even though he was sort of, like, pioneering certain aspects of this genre in this classic, there are also just, like, basics of narrative that he does very well that also make it a classic, and well chosen subjects, certainly.
I had forgotten that the last clip we see of Dennis White in this is him saying, effectively, I never practiced criminal law again after this case. Because I thought the endeavor was pointless because the system that I once believed in is so broken that it is no longer set up to separate the innocent from the guilty. It's set up to score convictions the way basketball players should be assigned to hit free throws.
Yeah.
And I
forgot about that too until you brought it up again. And he seemed so sad. Like, this was probably 8 or 10 years away now, this decision, from when the filmmaker's talking to him. And he still just looked like phased still by it.
He reminded me of, like, when Joseph Mitchell tried to, like, you know, tell the story of Joe Gould, this crazy street person in New York who always claimed to have written this 1,000-page history of humanity, which turns out was a complete lie. And Joseph Mitchell, like, wrote this New Yorker article at the end of an incredibly distinguished, like, several decade career of writing for the New Yorker called Joe Gould's Secret, and never wrote another word again.
Mm.
And over the neck, but lived another, you know, 40 years or something, and came into his office at the New Yorker several times a week. And the picture of him just sitting there, like being so heartbroken, I'm assuming, at having his faith shattered in something he believed in. I almost felt like one of the many things that The Thin Blue Line does, that a great documentary does, is that it compels you to continue on the story of the characters past the point when the documentary ends. And,
yeah.
And I heard myself saying, God, the story of Dennis White is a great story. Where's the rest of it? Along with the story of Edith James. And I would love to know more about, like, that police official from Vider who had many a dealing with David Harris. And...
Yeah. Yeah, who was, you know, gentle but unstinting in his assessment of David's truthiness.
Yeah.
This is not perhaps the best at centering the victim in all of this. I think possibly because the injustices that were undertaken in the name of avenging the victim were so egregious, but it is good at giving you a broader, like, a bigger picture and a broader context for the way that these crimes and cases, whether mishandled or not, do have their rippling effect on everyone involved, the community, the attorneys for both sides, families you don't see as much, and Adams's brother, even though he sort of figures in the narrative of the night of the murder, is unseen. I thought that was good, and, like, the placement of that last interview was well chosen. And of course the notorious interview that kind of turned this into an instant, like, film school topic and genre classic, Errol Morris's camera broke, so he had to do his final interview with David Harris just audio, which I think makes it much more effective because you can't see David Harris making glib faces and just lying the way you have the rest of the film. Like, there's something about his on-camera presence that is fatuous. Maybe that's just because I already know he did it, but there is this moment where you can tell that he's coming as close as he feels he can to admitting that he did it. And at the end, I almost felt sorry for him.
Yeah.
So here's, let's play clip 11. It's not exactly that I felt sorry for him. Let me think about what I'm really trying to say. Let's have a listen.
Is he innocent? Did you ask him? Well, he's always said he's been innocent. There you go. Didn't believe, huh? Criminals always lie. Well, what do you think about whether or not he's innocent? I'm sure he is. How can you be sure? Because I'm the one that knows. Were you surprised that the police blamed him? They didn't blame him. I did. A scared 16-year-old kid. He sure would like to get out of it if he can.
Yeah, I guess I don't. It's not that I feel sorry for him. It's that it's a little more explicable. I mean, I say frequently on this podcast, like, it can be a little difficult to sort of try to, like, relate to or explain the behavior of sociopaths because we, the commentators, do not. We are not sociopaths and do not think that way. And so it can be maybe a little bit of a struggle to just sort of not empathize, but relate in any way to the way that they think. But in this sequence, there is a sort of glimmer of recognizable human regret in David Harris, that he's like, I don't think he necessarily regrets anything that he did in the situation except to throw Adams under the bus. And I think he does regret that. I think, I mean, maybe it's just like mirroring behavior that he's seen non-sociopaths expressing. But I mean, I don't know. There is like a heaviness to his voice, and it's like, this is my sort of chance to at least undo one thing. I don't know.
You never get the sense in this movie that David Harris is a dimwit. Like, nor strangely enough do you get the sense that he was sort of destined for this life, because the cop from Vider they speak to, you know, says that, like, David had three siblings, no one in his family has a criminal record. Like, this is, he wasn't a bad seed grown from poisoned soil. Like, he was.
Well, and then David himself tells this story about his brother drowning and how his father sort of never forgave him, even though that was totally irrational. And then while he's telling the story, he's like, maybe that's something that stays with you. I don't know. And then he gives this very tiny, almost imperceptible look at the camera to check to see if we're buying it. And I'm like, I mean, he's a bad guy. He's just a bad guy. And very experienced at bullshitting. Like, he's a compulsive liar. Yeah. And but he's just one of those guys that's like, well, you know, officer, I sure would love to tell you everything I know, and is helpful and says a bunch of BS. And then here's where you end up.
Right. And I think you're right. Like that is the moment of like, no, David Harris isn't going to apologize for any of his crimes. But he also like, he's also not going because in his narrative of his own life, it's not like it's not like he feels he's innocent. It's not like he feels he had moral indignation around the things he did. He knows he's guilty. And so somehow in that knowledge, he is able to feel slightly guilty about the wrong person being convicted for what he did.
Yeah. And at the same time, as I suspect a, you know, narcissist, that he also sees an opportunity to once again be at the center of the story and the center of attention. Because he's on death row for something else, and the fuck else does he have to do, right? So,
yeah.
But yeah, this movie holds up. It really does. Like I said, that maybe the milkshake shot could have been cut by a couple seconds, but whether it's because this sort of rush to injustice is still occurring, or because Errol Morris, despite my shit talking about the Jeffrey McDonald thing, which I'm not going to stop doing, is a master of this form, it's absolutely worth watching, and it is on, I think, the crime doc Mount Rushmore. And if you've never seen it, listeners, I think you really owe it to yourselves to check it out, because a lot of what we see in the genre and how we see it started there in 1988.
Yeah. I mean, it was Errol Morris's third movie, and it's really like to borrow a simile I say too often, a third movie is like a third album. It's like when the band comes into their own, and this is really, you know, this is Errol Morris's.
You're done doing the labels suggestions.
this is his London Calling, or his Fear of a Black Planet, or, you know, this is the movie where he kind of becomes himself.
Where else can listeners visit the Mount Rushmore of your work?
You can find me on Twitter at WeegeeWeegeeE, on the internet, the traditional internet, at Kevin Smokler, SMOKLER.com. And you can find my three books at a library or bookstore near you.
Lovely. Thanks again for coming.
You're welcome, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, you'll have to declare your independence from this podcast next week, because I am off to celebrate my anniversary and also America. The week after that, Eve Beatty is back for I Love You Now Die. Until then, got a tip for The Blotter Presents? Find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can become an official Blotter tipster at the Patreon page, patreon.com/blotterpresents, and subscribe to that newsletter, blotterpresents.substack.com, or bestevidence.fyi. If you like the podcast, I'd love it if you tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so other listeners can find us. If you don't like the podcast, I'd love it if you keep that fact to yourself. My guest, once again, has been Kevin Smokler, and like he said, he's on Twitter at Weegee. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.